Mr. Stump took you through the period of time past Nero, I guess. I'm just reviewing his notes here very quickly to see how far he got last time. And some of the things I say today may repeat just a little bit, although I don't think too much, because you need to be familiar with some of these names that unless you've been a history buff, you may not keep clearly in your mind. And not that you are necessarily expected to keep all of these things clearly in your mind, but at least to have a good conversational ability about them. Some of the names of the Roman historians or Caesars or other personalities in this period of time. So with the beginning of persecutions under Nero in the 60s, you'll see on your handout there that there were a series of other persecutions by a variety of the Roman Caesars as time went along. Nero's persecution in the 60s is generally regarded as the first Roman persecution. It's a nice, easy thing to remember about it, about what you'd expect it to be called, since it was the first Roman persecution. Likewise, in the time of Domitian, for example, in the 90s, it was called the second Roman persecution, and so on through the persecutions that you will see there up into the 4th century, where finally, in the early 300s, the Emperor Constantine was converted, and thus we end major Roman government persecution of Christians. But there were 10 such persecutions in that period of time, some of them very severe. It was in the persecution of Domitian that the Apostle John was arrested and banished to the Isle of Patmos, which is significant to the church because it was on the Isle of Patmos as a prisoner that the Apostle John received the book of Revelation, inspiration from Christ. So, that's very important. I don't expect you, again, to memorize those long lists, but it's there for you so you can review easily. Now, we have noted already that the name, or one name, that appears in early church literature that Christians began to be called in the Roman Empire was the name Nazarene. This appears in the Bible, as well as in any literature about Christians in this period of time, what little bit there is. I think you're familiar with the title, but we can talk just a few moments about it, because it is with this name that you would look in the index of any literature you may be perusing on early church history. If you want to know about the church in the first two or three centuries, look in the index of a church history book or in the reference section of an encyclopedia under Nazarene, and you'll find a little bit about it. And I'll read you some of the things you will find. The information, as we've already noted a couple of classes back, is pretty sketchy, however, and there's not much to be said. Perhaps the best statement on Nazarenes is from the 11th edition of the Encyclopedia Britannica. It is very short. There is not a lot of information available. Unfortunately, we would like to know so much more. But this is what the 11th edition of Britannica says, and I'll read it to you, under the article entitled Nazarenes. An obscure Jewish Christian sect existing at the time of Epiphanius. That is, in the late 300s. So, in the late 300s, the encyclopedic research still sees a group of early Christians called Nazarenes in Colle Syria, Decapolis, and it names a number of places that are not familiar to us, unless we look them up, where they existed, where branches of them resided. According to the authority Panarion, who is one of the ancient historians not so familiar, you don't need to write all this down because you can look it up in the encyclopedia, make what notes you want. You can write down just a brief note or two. According to Panarion, they dated their settlement in Pella from the time of the flight of the Jewish Christians from Jerusalem immediately before the siege in A.D. 70. He characterizes them as neither more nor less than Jews, pure and simple, but adds that they recognize the new covenant as well as the old. So here you have Christians under the name Nazarenes existing for two or three more centuries in the East who maintained their Jewish heritage, probably were nationally Jews for the large part, but that they accepted what was generally regarded as the New Covenant or New Testament of the Bible. They believed in the resurrection. They believed in one God and His Son, Jesus Christ. That's all very nice because we can say at least they did not have anything said of them that we have to reject them, as we'll notice in some of the groups a little later on, if it's true. But what is said of the Nazarenes, we can say, well, yes, I can accept that. That's fine. I'm glad it's there. He cannot say whether their Christological views were identical with those of Cerinthus and his school, or whether they differed at all from his own. That is the one writer who was writing about them. This, as you know, became a controversy of who was Christ. Was he God in the flesh? Was he God incarnate? What was he? Was he an angel made into man? You know, what did he exist before his human birth? If so, what was he before his human birth? You know, these are questions that have plagued people who don't really understand the Bible, even in the Christian world. And Cerinthus was one of the early heretics of the church. We've mentioned his name a little bit, but we'll continue now, this next class or so, to mention him, and then we'll pass along in time. But Cerinthus is certainly a name of one of the major heretics late in the first century, in the days of the Apostle John, you need to be familiar with. Jerome, who was one of the Catholic Church Fathers, says that they believed in Christ, the Son of God, born of the Virgin Mary, who suffered under Pontius Pilate and rose again. But adds, and this is the writing from one of the Catholic Fathers from a later period of time, Jerome, writing about the Nazarenes in the East, says that, quote, desiring to be both Jews and Christians, they are neither one nor the other. And I think that's a pretty good summarization of how we would view Christians in the early church, or as far as that goes, how some people may view God's people today. They can't tell if we're Jews or Christians. And one group of people listening to us, hearing us talk about unclean meats and holy days and Sabbath, well, you're Jews. Then another group of people hear us talking about the resurrection and Christ and the book of Matthew and the Apostle Paul and the millennium and the second coming of Christ, will say, well, you're Christians. Desiring to be both Jews and Christians, they are neither one nor the other. And that's about what we are. We are not Jews. We are not Christians in the traditional sense of the mold. They used the Aramaic recension of the gospel according to Matthew, which they call the gospel of the Hebrews. But there would be nothing prohibiting that if the Bible, Matthew's gospel, were written originally in Hebrew or had been translated into Hebrew. There are both schools of thought, you know, that Matthew's gospel was written originally in Hebrew, then translated into Greek for the purpose of placing it in the Bible. Others believe it was written in Greek originally and translated into Hebrew for the Jewish contingent of the church or people in general. I don't know which is so. They called it the Gospel of the Hebrews, while adhering as far as possible to the Mosaic economy as regarding circumcision, Sabbaths, foods, and the like. They did not refuse to recognize the apostolicity of Paul or the rights of heathen, that is, Gentile Christians. Again, everything absolutely in order. We have no problems discerning who these people are, and though they must therefore be God's true people, the one true church that existed along even a couple of centuries later, and the writers describing them, their beliefs, doctrines, practices, and habits, do not say anything contradictory to the Scriptures. Whereas the church at Rome had abandoned the Jewish regulations on the holy days, the Sabbath, and the laws of unclean meats in the second century. So by that time, they were going their own way, and thus the Catholic writers from Rome looked at these Christians in the East, because that's where we're dealing with them geographically, where they lived, and described them as retaining the doctrines faithfully that they had received, at least that part of them. And of course, we know from the Bible that circumcision was always an issue among the Jewish Christians, and that there never was a prohibition of the Jewish Christians continuing circumcision. That's perfectly all right. And to this day, you may choose to do that on your own for whatever reason you may choose it. Although Paul made it clear that for religious reasons it wasn't necessary. But they did continue, and so that would not be unusual that they would continue to do that. These facts, taken along with the name and geographical position of the sect, leads to the conclusion that the Nazarenes of the 4th century are, in spite of Epiphanius' distinction, that's another author that we won't get into. Now see, when you read an article like this, all of a sudden, if you don't have background into it, you've got all kinds of problems because your education don't know what it's talking about. You never heard of some of the geographical. You never heard of Panarion. I mean, I'm assuming most of you have never heard of Panarion. Don't know who he is. You may not know about Cerinthus. You may not know about Jerome. You have words and titles that can be strange to you. Apostolicity, or some of the other, recension of the gospel. And, you know, here's a short little article. You see where historically, educationally, you can be kind of confused or lost if you're not careful. You can skip over a lot of those kind of things, and I'll try to only clarify the ones that are important. So I don't need to worry about Epiphanius, a not-so-important author who at least is quoted. If you want to know more about it, you, of course, can go to those sources. So we come into the 4th century, and the conclusion of the scholars who wrote this is that in spite of Epiphanius' distinction, these Nazarenes are to be identified with Ebionites. Now we come to another word that may not be familiar to you. Ebionites. E-B-I-O-N-I-T-E-S. Ebionites. Another name applied to groups of Christians in the early centuries that present some confusion. Now you should realize from what Mr. Stump pointed out in one of his lectures mentioning Gnosticism, that we begin in the earliest times through Simon Magus and others like him to mix in different philosophies with Christian practices and ideas and philosophies. And so you have Christianity beginning to fragment in the very earliest years. Simon Magus probably came in contact with the church within 2 years of its inception. Or in other words, around 33. He moved to Rome in the 40s. And his heresy of mixing up the Chaldean mystery system with Judaism, with the Samaritan religion, with new Christian doctrines spread into other areas. And others branched off from him. So you have the foundation of a variety of groups, most of them small and obscure and pass out of existence. Nazarenes are probably the one group of people that we look to as being the largest representation of God's true people during this period of time. And this just about says all we know about them. The Encyclopedia Britannica summarization, you see, is very condensed, very concise. Now, if you would look up Nazarenes in a more modern edition of the Encyclopedia Britannica, it would probably be only half this. I read you the whole thing. That's it. So, the modern edition just has a short paragraph that may say an obscure Jewish Christian sect existing at the time of Epiphanius in Eastern Asia Minor. Into the story of Nazarenes, because you see the Encyclopedia Britannica 11th edition is one with theological emphasis. That's why we always quote from it, or more often quote from it, than we do a modern edition, because the modern editions of encyclopedias emphasize science and technology and de-emphasize theology and shorten the versions so that they can put more about the more modern things. And that's why I advise you, if you do find a good edition of the 11th edition of Britannica for a moderate price, buy it. A moderate price would be in the $100 range, I think, for the set. 26 volumes or whatever it is. Usually leather bound. There are two editions. This one I have is the small edition with very little print and hard to read. There is a bigger edition, probably nearly twice as big as this, but much harder to keep on your bookshelves because it's larger and heavier and all that type of stuff, but much easier to read. You may find either edition. By the way, the 12th and the 13th editions of the Encyclopedia Britannica are just additions that take off from the 11th and are equally good. I don't remember when they made a change. I presume the 14th, but I'm not positive of that. But if you do find one in a bookstore, the 11th, 12th, or 13th editions, this is the early part of this century, early 1900s, when these were published, as opposed to the modern editions of the Britannica that you may buy now for, what, $800 or $1,000 from a salesman who comes to your door. Resist the temptation to spend that kind of money for a modern edition of Britannica. You can find one in the Salvation Army from some poor fool who bought it from the salesman and found he couldn't afford it or didn't use it and dumped it into the Salvation Army. That's the place to buy Britannica, not from the salesman who comes to your door. So that's what the encyclopedia says about Nazarenes. Some interesting observations. Did Mr. Stump have the time to discuss Pella and the flight of the Christians to Pella? At least mention it. There's not much to say about it, except that it occurred. So the Jewish nation revolted against Rome in 66. And Nero, who was Caesar at Rome, dispatched Vespasian, his leading general, over to the east to put down the rebellion in Judea. Started in Galilee. And of course, the Romans were much more powerful than the Jewish militia. And in the course of time brought Palestine, as they called it, back into submission. The final fall of Jerusalem did not occur until 70 AD. Now, part of the reason was because in 68, 2 years after the war began in the east, Nero died. And Roman government was in confusion. And of course, Vespasian, one of the leading generals of the empire, was a leading candidate to become Caesar. And so he had to rush back to Rome to involve himself in the political intrigue, and finally was able to become Caesar, to gain the priority, and was named Caesar in, I think, 69, if I have the dates correct on this sheet. He then dispatched his son Titus to be in charge of the army in the east, or it left his son Titus in charge of the army in the east, and it was Titus who completed the destruction of Jerusalem in 70. However, in 69 A.D., during the festival of Pentecost, as even Josephus states in his work, that God warned audibly with a voice his people to remove themselves from Jerusalem. The voice simply said, "Let us remove hence." This was in the summer, early summer of 69. Now remember Jesus' admonition to his church in Matthew 24 and Luke 21 and so on. "When you see Jerusalem encompassed with armies, know that her destruction is near. Let him that is on the rooftop not come down. You're out in the field, don't come back," and so on. "Get out and get out fast," was Christ's warning. And in 69 that came to pass. God's people who had faith and who understood must have removed themselves from Jerusalem in the summer of 69, a few months before, nearly a year before, the final conflagration of Rome and its ultimate destruction. And as you probably know, the destruction of Jerusalem in 70 AD is one of the great bloody wars of history. Terrible time. And of course, very important to Jewish history, but a predominant number of Christians were no longer there. And they removed themselves in the summer of 69, ever how long it may have taken them. Christ, remember, said, "Pray your flight be not in the winter or on the Sabbath day." So God warned them on Pentecost. Nobody understood it except God's people, even though apparently others heard the voice at the temple, the priests and others, did not understand the significance of it, and did not leave, of course. But God's people did, and they fled to a little town called Pella, P-E-L-L-A. Mr. Stump apparently again mentioned this, and they remained there for many years. Branches of them were still mentioned here. In fact, one of the geographical regions, I didn't read each of these hard to pronounce names, but among them were was the town of Pella, where Christians still lived into the 300s, into the 4th century. Pella is on the east side of the Jordan and south of the Sea of Galilee. You want to locate it on a map. Otherwise, of no major consequence as a major city. They just simply got out of there, Christians did. Even though later the persecutions were less, they did not in any massive numbers move back. By this time, Paul was dead. Peter was dead. James, the brother of Christ in Jerusalem, was dead. All martyred in the 60s. John was left alive, but We know little about him in the 70s and in the 80s, and we don't pick his story up until in the 90s, when he was an old man, and presumably the other apostles were dead, most of them suffering martyrdom, most of them out in the diaspora somewhere, not only of the Jews, but in the dispersion of Israel. And so they may have been one in India, and one in North Egypt, and seven in Europe somewhere, where they were with the lost tribes, and we don't know anything about the success or failures of their ministry. Any successes they enjoyed were stamped out and were not perpetuated. That is, there were no colonies of Christians that perpetuated themselves over the many centuries. They all died out in the second century, or by the third or fourth, certainly. There are no historical evidences of the success of the ministry of a Thomas or a Matthew or whoever it might have been that was out there. Therefore, I do not deal in this class with any speculation about where did the 12 apostles go. Dr. Hay wrote an article on that some years ago. It is not generally out in wide distribution now, but of course it's in the library. And if you wish to peruse it to see what speculation is available about where the 12 apostles went, that's fine. You may do so. But we're not sure, because neither secular history nor, most of all, the Bible tell us about the work of the apostles in general. So Peter is dead. Paul is dead. James is dead. John is left to continue the work. And late in the first century, we pick up his story headquartered in Western Asia Minor, in the seven church circuit area from Ephesus to Laodicea. And you're familiar with the geographic distribution of those seven cities in Western Asia Minor where churches existed that became symbolic in the book of Revelation of the passing time that would go through the centuries of God's church. Interesting, this is where God headquartered his work late in the century. In the meantime, the Christians at Pella continued to one degree or another faithful to the way of God, but were not the principal headquarters after John's work in the seven church circuit there ended in the turn of the century. Let me read you just a little bit more about Nazarenes of this period of time. I'll quote some references for you. Again, I don't, because I have a lot of reading to do some of these classes, which I'll do it for you. So you don't have to worry about it. You can take brief notes, but you can take down the titles and authors if you would like to gather more information on your own. This is from the Biblical and Theological Dictionary. Biblical and Theological Dictionary by Watson on Nazarenes. Nazarenes is a name given to Christians in general on account of Jesus Christ being of the city of Nazareth, but was in the 2nd century restrained to certain Judaizing Christians who blended Christianity and Judaism together. They held that Christ was born of a virgin and was also in a certain manner united to the divine nature. They refused to abandon the ceremonies prescribed by the law of Moses. They rejected those additions that were made to the Mosaic institutions by the Pharisees and doctors of the law, and admitted that the scriptures were both the Old and the New Testament. Now, are we all... No, that's good. I'm going to say, amen, brother. That's what we're looking for. It doesn't tell us much, but at least it tells us in the 2nd century there were still some people who remained faithful to God's way of life, even though you may not agree with the terminology in every case. You at least see people who were faithful and who kept the Old and the New Testament both. The fathers frequently mentioned the Gospel of the Nazarenes, which differs nothing from that of St. Matthew, but was afterwards corrupted by the Ebionites. This other group of people I've mentioned coming back at us again. We'll come back to them. These Nazarenes preserved this first gospel in its primitive purity. Some of them were still in being by the time of Jerome, who does not approach them with any errors. Jerome is, I don't have the dates all memorized myself, I think as late as the 4th or 5th century when we come to Jerome, one of the Catholic writers. So considerably later, they still talk about these early Nazarenes. Another article, here's another work, The Ecclesiastical History of the 2nd and 3rd Centuries. That's the title of the book. The Ecclesiastical History of the 2nd and 3rd Centuries by John Bishop. There can indeed be little doubt that after the promulgation of Adrian's edict, those Christians who had united the observance of the Mosaic ritual with the profession of the gospel, fearful lest they should be confounded with the Jews, gradually abandoned the Jewish ceremonies, so that in the time of Tertullian, the number of Judaizing Christians had become extremely small. We are now speaking of those whom Mosheim called Nazarenes. You probably should also be familiar with the name Mosheim. He is a church historian, comparatively modern vintage, M-O-S-H-E-I-M. And would be a good volume for you to own, again, if you ever run across one in a used bookstore, or I don't think it's in print any longer, in fact, so you can't buy it new, and I'm not sure of that. Mosheim's church history. You should be familiar with him. He's a major writer and a good person to have to quote. We are now speaking of those whom Mosheim calls Nazarenes. And in the footnote, says that they, though restrained from Mosaic rites, believed all the fundamental articles of the Christian faith. That is, Nazarenes. Ebionites, on the contrary, who also maintained the necessity of observing the ceremonial, rejected many essential doctrines of Christianity. So we find in early church history two groups of people who were identified with Jewish Christian traditions as opposed to non-Jewish. That's what later became the church at Rome. They did away with the Judaizing. And you see the observation in church history that in the passing of time, those who had adhered rigidly to some of the ancient Jewish traditions gradually abandoned them as a result of the pressures of a growing Christian movement that had first abandoned and later forbidden Judaizing in the church. On the other hand, a group of people rigidly adhered to the Jewish Christian, to the Jewish principles, but were also Christian, but more Jewish than Christian, and they were called Ebionites. And as far as we can observe in our studies of early church history, we do not strongly feel any, or certainly not many, among the Ebionites were God's true people. That Ebionites are not God's church. And that Nazarenes are at this time. So let me just mention briefly a few things about the Ebionites to summarize who they were and what they believed that you will get out of a variety of reference works. And you see why I have no church history textbook I can turn to, because I have to go get these things out of all these different books, and no one book that I know about really puts them together in the best possible way. So we don't have a textbook that we can go to, although there are some who come close. I've mentioned, I think, Duggar and Dodd's work of the Seventh-day Church of God as being a good reference tool, but not very authoritative, as an example. So on Ebionites, you will find that they are a group of predominantly Jewish Christians who lived in the first through the third centuries. Most of them were Jewish converts to the group. There are two possibilities given in the reference works to their name. One is that they are named after a man named Ebion, E-B-I-O-N. The other is that that name in an original language of the time means the poor, and that they were called Ebionites because they were poor. Difficult to know which. It's probably not important for us to know. They were predominantly Jewish, did not generally accept Gentiles into their group. So we would say they did not accept the teachings of the New Testament church. In fact, mostly Ebionites are known for their rejection of the writings of the Apostle Paul. While they accepted Christ and accepted some Christian tenets, they rejected the writings of the Apostle Paul. And they adhered, in some cases, rather rigidly to certain Jewish principles. They maintained the rites of circumcision. As an example, they were influenced by Gnosticism, as almost everybody else was in this time frame, the popular philosophy. They believed that God created the world, but they did not practice everything that God said. They were vegetarians, largely at least. They observed the Sabbath until into the 4th century. But after that, we're absorbed into Sunday-keeping churches, as almost everybody else was, or Sunday-keeping movement. And they largely began in the course of time to practice celibacy, as they refused marriage and sexual relations. Now, what would you conclude is the logical thing to happen to a group that adopts celibacy as a doctrine? They'd die out, right? I mean, one, you don't perpetuate yourself through the birth process, and two, it's pretty hard to get people to convert to your group. Any group that accepts and then teaches celibacy is destined to failure. And it can only live a generation or two or three. So, Ebionites eventually died out. What we know of them from the resource materials, rather strange doctrines, they believed that Christ was an angel 96 miles high. That the Holy Spirit is a woman of similar stature. Bizarre doctrines. The 11th edition of the Encyclopedia Britannica, I'll refer to again and read you the quote there. You need to probably learn you a good abbreviation system so you don't have to write all these book titles out every time. 11th edition of Britannica states, on the Ebionites, Irenaeus, one of the Catholic writers, sheds no light on the origin of the Ebionites, but says that while they admit the world to have been made by the true God, in contrast to the demiurge of the Gnostics, that's what Gnostics had to explain, they thought the world came into being by a demiurge. But here again, if you don't know that word, it's a strange word to you and nothing comes to your mind. They held the Cerinthian view of the person of Christ, used only the Gospel of Matthew, rejected Paul as an apostate from the Mosaic law, the customs and ordinances of which, including circumcision, they steadily adhered. They kept both the Jewish Sabbath and the Christian Lord's Day. You see, they absorbed Sunday into their customs as well in the course of time. And at the end of the 2nd century and beginning of the 3rd, these people exchanged their simple Judaistic creed for a strange blend of Essenism, that is, of the Essenes, the Jewish sect of the Essenes, and Christianity. It was claimed that Christ was an angel 96 miles high, accompanied by the Holy Spirit, a female angel of the same stature, had given the revelation to Elchasai in the 3rd year of Trajan. Now, it becomes a rather bizarre kind of doctrinal development that comes out of it. And it would seem to me that they turned their minds over to demoniacal heresies, if these things are true about them. I must always preface our statements that we read in history with, if these things are true. Because if you picked up a book today to read about the worldwide Church of God and what it believes, would you find what we really believe? And you all know the answer to that. You read in the L.A. Times sometimes what we think, do, or believe. And you have to laugh and to keep from crying because it is so wrong. Thus, if the Ebionites were really God's people, but their persecutors wrote or made up or misunderstood these things, then, of course, you have a whole different ballgame. So I presume that if these things are truly what they believed, we can logically conclude that they were not part of the true church. Now, you may find in some of our early literature, before we really got a chance to study into some of these things, that in passing there may be a reference to early Christians, such as Nazarenes, Ebionites, and names the names of things, and you see that name in there. This could have been in the 50s. You might find an article if you're perusing back in something in the Good News magazines. Don't let that upset you, because at that time we simply had not gone through this. And I'm not saying that Ebionites are not the true church. It's just that if this evidence is true, then we would logically conclude they're not. And I think a supposition, and this is just a personal supposition. You know, there was such a controversy in Acts chapter 15 over circumcision that Jewish Christians who were in the church had a very difficult time with the Apostle Paul and his doctrines and beliefs, didn't they? Paul persuaded, I mean, look at it carnally. Paul persuaded the elders of the church in Jerusalem to accept the doctrine that Gentiles didn't have to be circumcised. And Peter and James proclaimed that, wrote letters about it, and commissioned Paul to preach that truth, which was true, because God led them in that conference. But can you not imagine that some of those ultra-right-wing Jewish people could not accept the doctrine of Paul's teaching, which that's how they viewed it now, and thus had a problem with it. Because you find, you see, that conference was 49. You find in, let's say, 10 years later, when Paul comes back and is arrested in Jerusalem, where James has to say to Paul, "Brother Paul, you must realize that here in the church in Jerusalem, we have members who don't understand what you're teaching, and still to this day think you're teaching contrary to the law. Now, to show them you're not teaching contrary to the law, I would like you to go with these men who have a vow upon them, go to the temple, be at charges with them, pay the temple service fees, through the ritualistic service of the week that it takes to relieve oneself from a vow. You go in and out of the temple with these people to show you are not opposed to these things." This was 10 years after the conference in round numbers. There still were people in the church in Jerusalem who so retained their Jewish heritage and ideas that I could see among them some few who had a problem with Paul, could not accept his writings. Pass that along another generation, and you have them rejecting the Apostle Paul and his writings, and of course, departing from the truth. We have today any number of splits of splits of splits off of this church of all things. People who have felt they needed to retain the name of the church. And I don't remember all of the names, but they're incorporated here and there around the world with the name somehow Church of God in them. Often men, families who used to be ministers in this church, and people who make up their congregations who used to be members of this church. And so you have the 20th century Church of God and the International Church of God and the... what are some of the others? The Church of God at Santa Rosa, the Family Church of God, right down here a few miles from here, one of our ministers started. Church of God here, Church of God there, all the different names and the titles, and they used to be of us, but they've departed. Some of them have retained a lot of doctrinal teachings, and others of them have just sort of drifted and dissipated into theological research groups that accepted traditional Christianity's views of many different things. I don't want to, you know, embarrass anybody. I'm not speaking evilly about them. I don't want to get a, you know, get any kind of riled up about it. I'm just saying that I could see this happening in the early church 20 years ago. I couldn't see it happening ever. I mean, I didn't understand that. Why would people do these things? But it's happened to us, and so it gives us maybe a capacity to see what was happening in this time. So I could see from the Judaizing Christians, the inability to deal with Paul's teaching, because he did demonstrate, and God led the church to understand, that it was not necessary for Gentiles to do some of the things that had been required in the Jewish tradition. But then you drift from the truth, and you cut yourself off from the body, you become subject to doctrinal error. And the first thing you know, you start hearing about bizarre doctrines. Again, I don't want to get, you know, don't want to carry this thing too far, but one group that split off from this church, and the minister used to be in this church, claimed revelations from the Lord, and that the church was going to be carried to a place of safety. Only that place of safety was in outer space. And that the Assyrians were not the Germans and Europeans of today, but that they were some kind of aliens from outer space. And an invasion was being planned. And that he and his group have been long anticipating and have set, I think, at least 10 or a dozen different dates for the coming of the kingdom. And they go out and stand on the side of the river and wait for the Lord to sweep down in a fiery chariot, like in Elijah's time, and sweep them all away. You know, bizarre stuff. Really bizarre. At least I think it is bizarre. Like 96-mile-high Christs and Holy Spirit ladies. Bizarre doctrines that your mind can go off into when you deviate and depart from the truth. So maybe there was some commonality early on of these Christians when you cut yourself off from the body and go out that way and God's Spirit no longer works with you, you come up with these kind of ideas. Strange. This is a rather long title of a book, not a major work, so you probably don't need to worry about writing it down, but I'll mention a quote that I found interesting. This is from a man named Burton, whose work is entitled Lectures Upon the Ecclesiastical History of the First Three Centuries. You ever notice that these historical theses and doctoral dissertations always have these long, long involved titles? They can't make a simple title, but that's the way it works in the scholarly world. He says, Burton says, it may have been the success of Carpocrates and Cerinthus, which led some persons in the neighborhood of Pella to embrace the heresy described above as that of the Ebionites, the fugitives from Jerusalem. While some became true disciples of Jesus, others, as in the case of the spreading of new opinions, may have imperfectly learnt or ignorantly perverted the real doctrines of Christianity. So you have coming out of Pella and in the East a Jewish group that departs from the rational, stable truths of the Bible and eventually fades out of existence by accepting celibacy as the doctrine of the way of life. They inherited that from the Essenes, that Jewish group, not Christians at all that we know of, who moved down near the Dead Sea in the early Christian period, who also faded out of existence as a result of the doctrine of celibacy. So I don't think that we have any trouble, based on the evidence we see, that Ebionites should not be regarded as part of the true church. Nazarenes, on the other hand, probably were those who retained the truth in the East of the church. So we may say something about the two groups then. Nazarenes, on the one hand, you make a little column. They moved to Pella. They believed both the Old and New Testament. They believed in the resurrection. They believed in one true God and His Son Jesus Christ, born of the Virgin Mary. They retained the Sabbath. On the other hand, there were Ebionites, who were largely, if not exclusively, Jewish by race or national. They rejected Paul. They insisted on circumcision and other Mosaic tradition. They did believe in God, but had rather strange ideas about who Christ was. So we would not accept them as the church. I have mentioned already the writers of the early Catholic Church. The title we apply to them is Anti-Nicene, A-N-T-E, Anti-Nicene, meaning before the Council of Nicaea. Let me mention three that I think you should be familiar with and we'll talk about over the course of the next few classes, off and on, some of their writings. In the early part of the 2nd century, 100 to 167 A.D., is Justin Martyr. M-A-R-T-Y-R. Justin Martyr. Overlapping him, continuing to late in the century, 130 to 200 A.D., is Irenaeus. I-R-A-N-A-E-U-S. Irenaeus. And following him, perhaps the most important of the anti-Nicene fathers as a writer, from 264 to 339, is Eusebius. E-U-S-E-B-I-U-S. Eusebius. You can buy his paper-bound volume in our bookstore, I would imagine, or at least have it ordered if it's not stocked. I don't request it to be stocked because I don't require you to buy that many books, but you might want to own your own copy of Eusebius. Otherwise, you can do research in the library and look in the Anti-Nicene Light Fathers to find the others. Three Roman writers you should be familiar with, their names, what they did, because you will find some import to church history as you read them, although you will only find very scattered things. You'll look in the index of their works to find something. Suetonius, S-E-U-T-O-N-I-U-S, Suetonius. We call him the biographer of the Caesars, and that's his contribution to history. Almost everything you see written about Caesars, the early Caesars of Rome, will quote Suetonius. Next, the Roman historian of this time period is named Dio, D-I-O. And then there is Pliny, or Pliny, some call him, P-L-I-N-Y. There were two. I've forgotten, I didn't make a note as to which this was. It seems like this is the younger. Pliny the younger. There's Pliny the elder and Pliny the younger. I think this is the younger, but I'll have to confirm that. Who was a lawyer who wrote about Christians. He was dispatched late in the first century, early second, and he wrote about Christians in his area because he was called upon as a lawyer to prosecute them. Wrote about them. So we have a little bit of comment in Roman history to those things. I think Mr. Stump had the time to mention a couple of key Roman Caesars where persecution entered in. The Emperor Domitian was the emperor I mentioned earlier. He's 81 to 96. It's on your chart there. Domitian, who was responsible in the 90s for the persecution of the Apostle John. Domitian was a son of Vespasian, who was the general I mentioned, who started the invasion of Palestine but had to come back to Rome to become Caesar. His next son, Titus, also became a Roman emperor, as did his other son, Domitian. So the Vespasian family controlled Rome from the late 60s, well past the turn of the century, or into the... Yeah. Well, I don't remember. Trajan comes along next. I don't remember his family lineage. But the latter part of the first century was all Vespasian and family. To the Romans, atheism meant refusal to worship the Roman gods. You should understand the Roman definition of atheism. Because sometimes when you're reading about this period of time, you will see Christians accused of atheism, and it might confuse you. Say, wait a minute, how could Christians be atheists? That's in the Roman definition of the term. Atheism meant refusal to worship Roman gods. Christians refused to worship Roman gods and thus were considered atheists by the Romans. And that's why some of the persecutions came. Domitian instituted moral reform and religious revival in the Roman tradition in his period of time, and thus the Christian persecution in his period of time. And so the significance of Christians in the empire at that time was very great, because it prompted this Roman emperor to institute these policies, and it caused a great deal of trouble. We'll pick up the story with him because we want to talk about his involvement with John and what happened to John and those then at that period of time. So we've come to the end of the first century and rounded off numbers anyway, and can proceed from here.